This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Roger McDonough, filling in for Ross Chambliss. Today on the program, we're airing this year's Frederick W. Reynolds Lecture, presented by the Department of Continuing Education and Community Engagement at the University of Utah. This year's lecture was delivered last week on March 29th by Tim Chambliss, associate professor and lecturer in the University of Utah's Department of Political Science, and an academic outreach coordinator for the University of Utah's Hinckley Institute of Politics. First off, for full disclosure, we need to acknowledge that Tim Chambliss is currently a board member of KCPW, and he's also the father of the producer and regular host of this program, Ross Chambliss. Tim Chambliss's talk is titled Trump, the Unprecedented President. Historically, according to Chambliss, quote, the United States has never had a president like him, a multi-billionaire businessman with no previous government experience, the oldest first-term elected president, twice divorced, and a television showman. Every day, his name dominates news reports. His supporters praise his forceful actions and hope he can deliver on campaign promises. His critics fear he is weakening the nation, and many are considering impeachment. As Americans and Utahns, where do we draw the line between taking him literally and taking him seriously? End quote. Here's Tim Chambliss.
It's a documented fact, I can say. Trump is unprecedented. Donald Trump, as a presidential candidate, was certainly unconventional, and unconventional in so many ways. How can we understand this unprecedented president? Well, I conducted an internet search on established news outlets. I used search terms Trump and unprecedented. Since June 2016, the search yielded 114 news articles with the terms Trump and unprecedented in the headlines. Examples. June of last year, Trump's 3,500 lawsuits, unprecedented for a presidential nominee. Last July, Trump's NATO comments, unprecedented. Last September, scope of Trump's falsehoods, unprecedented for a modern presidential candidate. Just after the election, 12 days, NPR reported, Trump's private business dealings pose unprecedented conflicts of interest. This year, just before the inauguration, the unprecedented unpopularity of Donald Trump. The day before the inauguration, Trump to leave unprecedented number of federal jobs vacant. Last month, Groundhog's Day, officials warned Trump against unprecedented plan to staff cabinet without ethics vetting. February, Trump, in unprecedented fashion for a president, rips press. 20 days ago, Hayden, Michael Hayden, former NSA CIA director, Hayden, Trump unprecedented in discrediting his own intel agencies. 2 weeks ago, how Donald Trump sparked an unprecedented crisis among Jewish Republicans. 2 weeks ago, the Ides of March, Trump calls Hawaii's judge ruling against revised travel ban unprecedented judicial overreach. The 21st of March, Trump's unprecedented war on ethics. And also, Trump promises GOP unprecedented power if it votes with him on health care bill. I like this one. February 7th. Please stop calling everything Trump does unprecedented. Now, prior to the election, during the campaign, what promises did Trump make? Okay. Repeal and replace Obamacare, the 2010 Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Ban Muslim immigrants from certain countries. Build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. Deport millions of criminal immigrants. Pressure U.S. companies not to leave the U.S. Undo international trade deals covering the last quarter of a century. Cut taxes for U.S. companies and raise import taxes on foreign companies. Eliminate many government regulations. Promote fossil fuels over alternative energy sources. Increase the military budget by nearly $60 billion a year. Ease tensions between the United States and Russia force China to behave in the international marketplace. Make NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, members, pay more for their defense, 28 members. Defeat Middle East terrorists, for example, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, other non-state actors. Return certain federal powers to state governments. Complete oil pipelines in North Dakota. Greatly change America's infrastructure. And you will remember, make America great again. These campaign promises alone make Donald Trump an unprecedented president and unpredictable. He said when he was interviewed by the Washington Post editorial board, quote, "I always say we have to be unpredictable." Now, prior to the election, do you remember that presidential campaign, and do you remember Election Day? Do you remember the election results? The popular vote, the electoral vote. Donald Trump, nearly 63 million votes. Hillary Clinton, nearly 66 million votes. The percentages, Donald Trump, a little over 46%, less than 50%. Hillary Clinton, just over 48%. Others, like Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate who spoke here, total almost 6%. But look at the Electoral College vote. 306 for Donald Trump, 232 for Hillary Clinton. Others, none. Hillary Clinton, she won the popular vote with almost 2.9 million votes ahead. She won the popular vote, but she is not the 45th president of the United States. Okay, by a show of hands, how many here thought Hillary Clinton was going to win the election on November 8th? Let me take a count while I count each one. Okay. Just want to check on you after eating dinner, okay? You are in good company, along with nearly all pollsters, pundits, and reporters. One American university professor, Alan Lichtman, in Washington, D.C., predicted on national television before the November 8th election that Donald Trump would win, a prediction that seemed wild and unbelievable. Well, the fact is, Donald Trump is the 45th president. Why? The answer, the Electoral College. A compromise, a concession to small states during the Constitutional Convention. Critics have called it outdated, undemocratic, an unfair winner-take-all system, unrepresentative. Supporters call it legal, constitutional. Since 1787, the last 230 years, five candidates for president have been elected by the Electoral College, although they actually lost the popular vote. The years, this is always an exam question for my students because I'm a date person, 1824, 1876, 1888, you might remember 2000, and 2016. Indeed, the Constitution's Article 1, Section 2, Clause 1, acknowledges the function of electors. Article 2, Section 1, Clauses 2 to 4, speaks of the role of the Electoral College. The 12th Amendment, ratified in 1804, specifies its procedures. This is important for us to recognize because, in terms of the Electoral College, we see that the Republican candidate won the election, not the one you thought would win the election. He won 30 states and one electoral vote from the state of Maine. He won over 270 electoral votes, the minimum needed. The fact is, a redistribution of 40,000 votes in three states in the upper Midwest would have made Hillary Clinton the 45th president. Now, we're here in the University of Utah football stadium. It seats 47,000. Been here for some sellouts. In other words, what I'm saying to you is if you look outside and you imagine all those seats filled, fewer people than the capacity of this stadium in three states, if the distribution had been different, would have given Hillary Clinton the presidency. That's how close this election was. Remember, we have an experiment in democracy here. Now, since 1972, going back close to 50 years, only three winning candidates won fewer electoral votes than Donald Trump in 2016. 1976, Jimmy Carter, and George W. Bush, both in 2000 and 2004. And you see more specifics on the screen. Okay, again, by a show of hands, can I ask you, how many here consider the Electoral College to be unfair, a winner-take-all system? Gotta get the news media here. Outdated, undemocratic, unrepresentative. Well, the fact is, we use the Electoral College process. Examples? Sports. We're in a football stadium. We also play baseball. I'm an old baseball umpire. So I have some questions for you. Think back not too long ago to last October, November. Last year, which teams played in the World Series? The Cubs, the Chicago Cubs, and the Cleveland Indians. Okay, good. How many games were played? Seven. Very good. Now it gets a little harder. How many runs did the winning team score? Sound like my students early in the morning. Okay. Another question. How many runs were scored by the team that lost in seven games? How many? How many runs in total? In total. You know the Chicago Cubs won in seven games. How many runs did they score? How many runs did the Cleveland Indians score? I'm probably the only one who thought of this. Okay. The answer is 27 each. They played seven games, an odd number. They each scored 27 runs, but at the end there was a winner and there was a loser, right? A winner-take-all system. We apply it to sports, and you know what? We applied it to the 2016 presidential election. Now, do we apply this to football? Last September 10th, I was one of those happy folks sitting here in my seat to watch a football game. It was the University of Utah playing a school in Provo. I forget the name. But I do remember that the red and white home team won the game by 1 point on the last play of the game. The result was a win for the University of Utah and a loss for the school down south. A winner-take-all scoring system determined the result. Well, the same is essentially true of states. States won, states lost in the Electoral College. Since November 8th, many have been asking these questions. Why did fewer people vote in 2016 than in 2012, despite the population increase over 4 years? Why? Why did Hillary Clinton, with more campaign dollars as a Democrat, not win the election? Why did Hillary Clinton win all three nationally televised debates but lose the general election? Why did women not vote in record numbers for a woman on a major party? Why did more Hispanics vote for Donald Trump than Mitt Romney? Why did urban black voters not vote in high numbers for the Democratic Party candidate? And why did poor rural voters throughout the country vote for a New York City billionaire? The answers, my friend, are blowing in the wind. I'm so glad you laughed at that. Highly esoteric, except for this audience.
If you're just tuning in, this is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Today, we're airing a talk delivered last week by Tim Chambliss, professor of political science, entitled Trump, the Unprecedented President. This was the Frederick W. Reynolds Lecture presented by the Department of Continuing Education and Community Engagement at the University of Utah. And now, back to the talk.
On January 20th, President Barack Obama peacefully relinquished power to his elected successor. Donald Trump delivered his inaugural address, witnessed a traditional parade, participated in evening presidential balls, and signed one bill. National Public Radio political reporter Scott Horsley said that day, quote, "If history is any guide, the new Trump administration will not be overly constrained by facts." Perhaps this is why, on January 20th, the New York Times columnist and PBS NewsHour analyst David Brooks wrote, "We have never, over the centuries, inaugurated a man like Donald Trump as President of the United States. You can select any random group of former presidents, Madison, Lincoln, Hoover, Carter, and none of them are like Trump." Brooks continued, "We've never had a major national leader as professionally unprepared, intellectually ill-informed, morally compromised, and temperamentally unfit." David K. Johnston, author of the book The Making of Donald Trump, and a New York Times reporter with an expertise in tax law, has said that Trump's philosophy is to get revenge. Donald is the most masterful manipulator of the conventions of journalism I've ever seen. Trump believes that even bad publicity is better than no publicity. Perhaps this is why Trump made these statements during the first days of his presidency. "We don't win anymore," words expressed at the CIA before the important wall. Maybe he had forgotten something called the Cold War. Maybe forgotten the Persian Gulf War. The day after inauguration, he says, "We have the all-time record in the history of Time magazine being on the cover." Well, let's see, he's been on the cover 11 times, Richard Nixon 55 times, Hillary Clinton 26 times. "I'm a very big person when it comes to the environment. I've received awards on the environment. I have spent a lot of time on the internet, and I cannot find any public record to claim, to document this claim. Between 3 million and 5 million illegal votes caused me to lose the popular vote. There is no evidence of mass voter fraud anywhere in the country to support this claim." On January 25th, quote, "I just signed two executive orders about Mexico that will save thousands of lives, millions of jobs, and billions of dollars." The fact is that the cost for a Mexico border wall is estimated to be $25 billion. The number of jobs gained is highly speculative, and it's highly doubtful that Mexico is going to pay for this wall. "We should have taken the oil in Iraq. And if we took the oil, you wouldn't have ISIS, and we would have wealth. If done, the U.S. would have been seen throughout the world as an international thief and a colonial power. We have spent, as of 1 month ago, $6 trillion in the Middle East." Well, between 2001 and 2014, the actual number is $1.6 trillion for wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Donald Trump is adding up veterans care for the next 30 years resulting from those conflicts, plus interest on the national debt for the next 30 years. Now as president, after January 20th, Trump has been unprecedented in his cabinet appointments. Nominees lacked substantial experience in those areas or simply opposed the department's past roles for which they were confirmed as secretaries. We see this for Secretary of State, Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Secretary of Education, and Secretary of Energy. You might remember the Secretary of Energy wanted to eliminate that department when he campaigned last time. His nominee to head the EPA has sued the Environmental Protection Agency 13 times and denies climate change is a fact. He was in the news yesterday when executive orders were signed. His senior policy advisor is a man with no past experience in government, calls himself a disruptor, and is linked to groups hostile to racial minorities. Stephen Bannon's now a member of the National Security Council, despite lacking the traditional national security clearances required. Trump has appointed his son-in-law to be a presidential advisor. I believe he's being called tomorrow before the Senate Intelligence Committee. His first national security director was fired when his pre-election links to Russian government officials was leaked to the news media. Not when it became known to the president, but when it was leaked to the news media. His press spokesman is a political operative from the Republican National Committee, not an experienced news journalist. Foreign policy is being managed in the Oval Office rather than the State Department. You may have noticed that the proposed budget for the State Department next year is a 31% cut. And I can't get a reservation for my students to visit or have a tour of the State Department. No tours of the State Department since January 20th. Many full-time staff positions in the federal bureaucracy have been left unfilled. And President Trump does not meet regularly with the White House press corps. He maintains two residences in New York and Florida, which require Secret Service daily protection. He does not spend weekends at Camp David, a retreat in the nearby Maryland woods, and he has announced that he will not be attending the White House Correspondents' Dinner on April 30th. You may remember the one in 2011. So, I say you do. Okay, let's consider Donald Trump in a historical perspective. Alexander Hamilton, at the Constitutional Convention and in the Federalist Papers, asserted, quote, "There must be energy in the executive. There must be energy in the executive if a president is to govern the new nation well." In 1789, when retired General George Washington became the first president, he was seen to be a war hero, the strong leader the new nation needed. Donald Trump has compared himself to another president, the seventh president, Andrew Jackson. Since January 20th, he has had a painting of Andrew Jackson hanging in the Oval Office of the White House. Trump admires Jackson for being a strong leader, for his commanding presence, for being a winner, unquote, for his 1828 winning campaign, for his support of the common man, for his populist appeal to rural America, for his rags to riches personal story. On March 15th, 2 weeks ago, President Trump flew to Tennessee to help celebrate the 250th anniversary of Andrew Jackson's birth. Trump praised Jackson's populist appeal to those Americans who felt ignored and unappreciated and exploited by Eastern elites. Note, in the years 1789 to 1829, 40 years, when retired General George Washington took office and retired General Andrew Jackson took office, America's population increased just about 10 times. In 1790, the American census had our country at a population of less than 4 million people in 13 states. A majority of Americans by 1828 were now living in the American West, a population of 40 million in total, and in the American West, Andy Jackson was their man. As president, Jackson would destroy the U.S. Bank. The National Bank was deeply resented by many living in Western states. And by 1837, when he left office, the United States was in the deepest economic recession in its young history. Jackson, unlike Trump, had been in the military. He was the general who had defeated the British at the Battle of New Orleans, concluding the War of 1812, the Second War of Independence. He had killed men in duels. The exact number is unknown. Jackson had earned a reputation as an Indian fighter. Jackson expected members of Congress, as well as the courts, to agree with him. When the Supreme Court upheld Native Americans' claims to their ancestral lands in Georgia and two significant cases in 1831, 1832, Jackson publicly rebuked the Supreme Court justices and ordered federal troops into the state of Georgia. Although Native Americans had won their cases in our nation's highest federal court, Jackson scorned Chief Justice John Marshall. He did not build a wall to keep Indian people out. Instead, soldiers were sent to relocate them. Thousands died in the forced relocation west to Oklahoma, an event we remember as the Trail of Tears. Jackson was a slave owner. Slaves had built his beautiful mansion in Tennessee and maintained the grounds of his plantation. Arguably, although he presented himself to be a leader for the common man in rural America, today he would be called a white supremacist. 2 weeks ago, when Donald Trump visited Andrew Jackson's home in Tennessee to celebrate that 250th anniversary of his birth, the president made no mention of Jackson's treatment of Native Americans or African Americans. Today is day 68 of Donald Trump's presidency. Legislatively, since January 20th, what has the president done? He's signed 10 bills. He has not vetoed a bill. He has signed, as of yesterday, 19 executive orders. Executive orders. The Constitution's Article 2 gives the president administrative power to issue executive orders. They're legal. Congress can review them. They order the federal bureaucracy to act within guidelines already authorized by Congress. Are they controversial? Yes, they can be. Why? They order actions while Congress deliberates. Examples. And thinking about history, go back to our first president, George Washington. 1794, Washington sent soldiers into Ohio to end a rebellion by farmers who had openly refused to pay the 1793 whiskey tax. 1861, Abraham Lincoln suspended the fundamental constitutional guarantee of habeas corpus throughout the Civil War, 4 years. 1863, President Lincoln issued his Emancipation Proclamation that slaves would be free when the Civil War ended. Now, technically, you may remember it's the 13th Amendment that actually liberated African Americans from slavery. 1942, President Franklin Roosevelt ordered over 110,000 Japanese Americans sent to internment camps for a period of 4 years. Not one had been arrested in a crime, and this was not done for Italian Americans or German Americans. 1948, Harry Truman ended racial segregation in the U.S. military. This 1948 executive order is precedent for admitting women into the military after the Vietnam War. Today, women are just about 20% of the U.S. military. This executive order would serve as a precedent for the military to accept gays and lesbians into all branches of the U.S. military. 1957, President Eisenhower ordered troops into Arkansas to enforce a federal judge's court order to racially integrate that state's public schools, an action opposed by that state's Democratic governor. In 1965, President Lyndon Johnson sent troops into Alabama to protest civil rights marchers, to protect civil rights marchers when they made a second attempt to walk peacefully across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. And in 1992, President George Herbert Walker Bush ordered troops into Los Angeles to stop rioting after a jury had acquitted four policemen in the Rodney King beating trial. I remember this very well because I was in Pasadena on University of Utah business during this riot. There was the smell of burning in the air. 34 people died. Since January 20th, what executive orders has President Trump signed since taking office? On January 20th, to reduce parts of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, not all, just part. On the 21st, to withdraw the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. On the 21st, also to block abortion access, dollars, and foreign aid. And then on the 24th, to approve the startup for a Keystone XL pipeline. and also to restart the Dakota oil pipeline, North Dakota. On the 25th, to begin a design for a wall between Mexico and the United States. On the 26th, to suspend the refugee program for 120 days, and also on that day to deny entry into the United States for immigrants from seven nations, and they're identified there. To expand on the 26th and strengthen the United States military. Specifically, it's unclear. To ban lobbying for 5 years after leaving the White House for certain lobbyists, and to invoke a lifetime ban on foreign lobbying for previous White House employees on a certain level. On the 28th, to reduce federal dollars to sanctuary cities. And you may recall that's been in the news in the last few days. And also on the 28th, to have the Pentagon, the generals, devise a military plan to defeat ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. I hear the natives are restless. Okay. On the 30th, to cut two federal regulations if one regulation is added. In other words, try to reduce the size of the federal bureaucracy. Remember, by definition, the president is the chief bureaucrat overseeing the executive branch. On the 30th, to maintain an Obama executive order to protect lesbians and gays workers in the federal bureaucracy. In February, to review parts of the 2010 Dodd-Frank Wall Street Act. Remember, this act of Congress was passed after we had the Great Recession in September, October of 2008. And then to revise the January 26 travel ban with a new one after a federal judge and judge panel had overturned the first one. And then a compromise plan to reorganize the executive branch, and as of yesterday, to reduce Environmental Protection Agency restrictions on coal and oil, on fossil fuels. Okay, can an executive order be appealed? And you may remember from the news, the answer is yes. Can it be not just appealed but overturned? Yes. Examples this year, the two executive orders dealing with travel bans imposed upon people from certain Middle Eastern countries, both overturned by federal judges on February 9th and March 10th. In response, President Trump was angry. He ridiculed the federal judiciary. He called one judge a fake judge. He called the appeals court, panel of three federal judges, an embarrassment. This starts to sound like Andrew Jackson. The difference between executive orders and bills. Again, executive orders can be issued without a committee hearing and with no public debate. The president can act unilaterally and quickly. In contrast, Congress has committee procedures before having floor votes are taken by all members of the House and Senate. Examples, last week, the House Intelligence Committee met, questioning the FBI Director, James Comey, and the National Security Agency Director, Michael Rogers, about the president's allegation, unprecedented allegation, that Donald Trump's New York City Trump Tower residence had been wiretapped by President Obama. No evidence was found by the FBI or the NSA or any other area in our government to support Donald Trump's unprecedented charge. On the 20th of this month, FBI Director Comey testified in open session before the House Intelligence Committee and confirmed the following. One, that the FBI since July of last year, remember July of last year was the month of the Democratic and Republican National Conventions. Since July of last year, the FBI has been conducting an ongoing investigation into Russia's, the popular term right now is meddling, but intrusion might be an appropriate synonym, in the 2006 presidential election. Two, the FBI has been investigating members of Donald Trump's campaign staff and current members of the Trump administration. Three, the FBI cannot at this time confirm or deny any wrongdoing by Trump or members of his administration. This is the administration and the president himself. Now, the NSA director, Michael Rogers, testified and confirmed that there's clear evidence of Russian interference in the 2016 election. And Rogers, under questioning, said that a nonpartisan special commission to investigate this matter might be appropriate. Now, if you don't know much about the NSA, you may know there's a large building at the southwest corner of this valley, okay? And If you wonder whether or not the NSA knows where you're sitting right now, the answer is yes. Okay? Now, on the 22nd, a week ago today, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee informed the president on the White House grounds of the current status of his committee's investigation. He did so without informing his fellow committee members, including his minority chair, who is from Pasadena. The next day, he apologized to his committee members. And since then, no hearings, but clear disagreement among the members. The 24th, last Friday, House Speaker Paul Ryan went to the White House, had lunch with the president, and informed the president that the Republican Party House members, in the clear numerical majority, could not agree on a specific bill that would repeal and replace Obamacare. That is, consensus could not be reached despite 7 years of Republican challenges and criticism. Therefore, to avoid an embarrassing political defeat, no vote was taken.
Thanks again for listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour here on KCPW. Today, we're bringing you the Frederick W. Reynolds Lecture, Trump, the Unprecedented President, presented by the Department of Continuing Education and Community Engagement at the University of Utah. The talk was given last week by Tim Chambliss, an associate professor and lecturer in the University of Utah's Department of Political Science. We return now to that talk.
Historically, I remember that George Washington observed at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 that what we are creating here is an experiment in democracy. Keep that in mind because those words from 1787 might be appropriate today. I remember Thomas Jefferson's admonition that all Americans should practice eternal vigilance with regard to government officials. As noted earlier, it is Andrew Jackson that President Trump admires and has praised. I perceive that President Trump is much more like another president, President Richard Nixon, than President Andrew Jackson. Why? Nixon. For years, he wanted to be president. As president, he valued loyalty over competence. Nixon listened to a few trusted him advisors. He isolated himself from party members. Nixon saw adversaries to be enemies. He often threatened military force. Nixon greatly resented the news media. He liked to provoke and taunt his critics. This was Nixon's public behavior as president, and his private behavior, as revealed in the secret Watergate tapes. Nixon felt the need to act tough. He was often ready to seek revenge. He could not admit mistakes. Nixon would blame others for his mistakes. He was quick to anger. Nixon often used profanity and name-calling. Nixon often stereotyped people, and he was very insensitive to minorities. Today, does this behavior remind you of anyone? The late Utah Senator Bob Bennett, who worked for Nixon and knew Nixon personally, told me that Nixon was not comfortable in his own skin, that Nixon was a terribly insecure man who let his fears and his own personal demons control him. On August 9th, 1974, Nixon resigned after 5.5 years in office. He declared on national television that he had lost the support of Congress. The fact is, Nixon would have been impeached within a month. Impeachment. The Constitution's Article 2, Section 4 reads, and you can see it on the screen, the President, Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for conviction of treason, bribery, high crimes, and misdemeanors. Remember that impeachment is the political equivalent of indictment in the criminal justice system. House members had determined in 1974 that Nixon was guilty of obstruction of justice, the slang term you may remember, cover-up. Cover-up of what? In other words, high crimes and misdemeanors within the context. really what that was all about was stealing an election, having barely lost in 1960, having barely won in 1968. The Watergate scandal began even before he was elected in 68, and certainly continued for 4 years, not just the June 17, 72 break-in. Stealing an election. Richard Nixon was popular in Utah. Utah voted to elect Nixon president 3 times. Last Monday, the Salt Lake Tribune published a Dan Jones poll with the banner headline, "Most Utahns behind Trump." I was trying to figure out that word behind here. Most Utahns behind Trump. But the number was 54-41, and that's very malleable. Those numbers are soft and hard. In contrast, nationwide today, Donald Trump is polling below 40% nationwide. When I try to understand Richard Nixon, and I wrote my dissertation and thesis on Watergate, Jack Anderson, and Richard Nixon. When I try to understand Richard Nixon, I think of my parents. You can tell we had quite a few discussions. When I try to understand Donald Trump, I think of a book published last year, Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance. Wonderful book. I find it profoundly candid and enlightening. This book has given me insights to my own family, and I had the good fortune on February 9th with my son to dash up to Weber State and be able to hear him speak. This book highlights the struggles of rural Americans who voted for Donald Trump, hopeful that he might improve the economy, hopeful that he might bring back those good jobs, hopeful that he would make America great again. Accordingly, in the week prior to November 8th, millions of Americans, undecided, decided to take a chance. Many financially struggling Americans decided to vote for a New York City billionaire. Aware of his provocative manner, aware of his continual false statements, aware of his erratic behaviors. Trump attracted many voters who wanted so badly to believe in him, like my parents wanted to believe in Richard Nixon. My parents' struggles give me insight into the 25% of Americans who in 1974, according to the Gallup poll, supported Richard Nixon on the day he resigned. My mom's family emerged from the Appalachian region of eastern Kentucky, moving to the river town of St. Louis for jobs. My dad grew up in poverty in the Texas Hill Country. World War II allowed my mother to become an Army nurse. In World War II, my dad was a pilot in the European theater and afterward attended college on the GI Bill. In 1969, Richard Nixon took office as president. My folks wanted to believe that Richard Nixon, a man whose own parents struggled and experienced hardship, a man who had risen from humble beginnings to be elected president, could help them. My folks defended Richard Nixon's every action. The press criticism was unfair and communist-inspired. Nixon was unfairly persecuted by his enemies, the liberal news media, the unpatriotic Congress, his own Republican Party, and those secret communists, the Democrats. My parents did not want to believe the unanimous ruling of the Supreme Court on July 24, 1974, Pioneer Day in Utah, ordering President Nixon to release his audio tapes, otherwise known as the Watergate tapes. Governmentally, historically, the justices declared for the first time in a Supreme Court case that no man is above the law, that even the President of the United States must obey the law. Impeachment is the remedy for a president who refuses to comply with the law. Unanimous decision by the Supreme Court. 2 weeks later, my folks were grieving when Richard Nixon resigned. Rather than remain to fight the impeachment process in order to vindicate his beliefs, his attitudes, his values, and his actions, Nixon, for 1 out of 4 Americans who supported him, Nixon was their symbol. A leader who understood their struggles and fears and had been tough with his enemies, both foreign and domestic. Okay, how about Donald Trump? Students and others who were stunned by the outcome of the November 8th election and or offended by the president's actions since then have asked me, can't we impeach him? I can't tell you how many times I've had that question posed to me. I have reminded them that the word impeachment appears four times in the Constitution. Education and women, nowhere to be found, by the way. Two presidents have been impeached. Nixon would have been had he not resigned. Impeachment for personal or political reasons? No. Impeachment for corruption and wrongdoing? Yes. Remember, treason, bribery, high crimes and misdemeanors. Do contacts with Russia constitute treason? Investigations are underway. Senate Intelligence Committee has a meeting, public meeting tomorrow. And we know the FBI and the NSA are conducting investigations as I speak. Bribery. The United States Constitution in both Article 1 and Article 2 declares that that federal government officials cannot receive any form of gifts or awards or bribes. The old word, emoluments, a word in common use in 1787, appears in our Constitution today. And today it would translate to gifts or awards or bribes. Article 1, Section 9, Clause 8, you can see on the screen. No person holding any office or profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of the Congress, accept any emolument, office, title of any kind whatsoever from any king, prince, or foreign state. Article 2, Section 1, Clause 7. The president, during the period for which he shall have been elected, shall not receive within that period any other emolument from the United States or from any of them, any of the states. President George W. Bush's legal ethics attorney, Richard Painter, and President Barack Obama's legal ethics attorney, Norm Eisen, together have documented numerous examples of Trump cabinet appointees and staff advisors with ethical conflicts. Directly or indirectly, they see violations of law. In fact, both Painter and Eisen have said repeatedly that Donald Trump has been violating federal law each day since he took the oath of office as the president. Their primary concern, bribery. What is bribery? It is not defined specifically in the Constitution. However, by statute, it is understood to be the illegal exchange of governmental favor for some form of financial gift or award. In other words, bribery is corruption. High crimes and misdemeanors. It's harder to define. We might consider President Trump's own words. President Trump, on November 22nd, 2015, just before Thanksgiving, he was in a live interview with ABC News television. And he said he would, quote, absolutely bring back waterboarding as an accepted form of interrogation. He characterized waterboarding as a form of strong interrogation of those suspected to be terrorists. Waterboarding. Torture, simulated drowning. Waterboarding is defined as torture by the United Nations. Waterboarding is strictly illegal under United States law. March 20th, 9 days ago, Senator Lindsey Graham, a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, questioned Supreme Court nominee Federal Judge Neil Gorsuch, President Trump's choice to replace the late Antonin Scalia. Now remember that in 2016, Senator Graham was one of 17 announced formal Republican candidates seeking the party's nomination for president. Remember that Senator Graham and Mr. Trump both expressed some harsh public criticism of one another Senator Graham, in his questioning of Judge Gorsuch, raised the subject of impeachment. In doing so, Graham was also speaking directly to President Trump. Senator Graham said, "In case President Trump is watching, which he may very well be, one, you did a good job picking Judge Gorsuch." There's laughter heard in the committee room. "And two, here's the bad part. If you start waterboarding people, you're going to be impeached." "Is that a fair summary?" he asked Judge Gorsuch. Judge Gorsuch, "Senator, the impeachment power belongs to this body, Congress." Senator Graham, "That's even better. Would he be subject to prosecution?" Judge Gorsuch, "Senator, I'm not going to speculate." Senator Graham, "But he's not above the law." Judge Gorsuch, "No man is above the law. No man." These exact words appear in the Supreme Court's historic case of United States of America versus Richard Milhouse Nixon, 1974. The unprecedented Supreme Court case that ordered President Nixon to turn over the tape recordings that proved he was guilty of obstruction of justice, the evidence that would move him to resign rather than face impeachment by the Congress. Senator Lindsey Graham is not the only public official who's raised the matter of impeachment. February 6th this year, CNN interviewed a member of the House who confirmed that inquiries are already underway, discussed in committees in the House about presidential behaviors that could lead to a bill of impeachment being introduced in the House. March 23rd, last Thursday, Nicholas Kristof, who has spoken on this campus, his wife spoke here in this building two nights ago, Nicholas Kristof, a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times columnist and investigative reporter, published a probing column in the Salt Lake Tribune, which had this provocative headline, "A Smell of Treason in the Air." Kristof asked, "Did a traitor work with Russia to help Trump?" In posing this question, Kristof links Richard Nixon to Donald Trump. Specifically, Kristof wrote that, quote, "Richard Nixon's secret efforts in 1968 to sabotage a U.S. diplomatic effort to end the Vietnam War, long rumored but confirmed only a few months ago, was meant to improve his election chances that year. After Nixon won, the war dragged on and cost thousands of additional American and Vietnamese lives. It's hard to see his behavior, Nixon's behavior, as anything but treason." Now, conservative Republican columnist George F. Will has also written about treason and Richard Nixon. The Baltimore Sun has published a story entitled, "Did Nixon Commit Treason?" But Nicholas Kristof says that now the FBI confirms that we have had an investigation underway for 8 months since July last year into whether another presidential campaign colluded with a foreign power as to win an election. To me, that too would amount to treason. Forcefully, Kristof asserts the fundamental question now isn't about Trump's lies or intelligence leaks or an inadvertent collection of Trump communications. Rather, the crucial question is as monumental as it is simple. Was there treason? Kristof concludes by quoting the award-winning historian Douglas Brinkley. Who says, "There is the smell of treason in the air," he told the Washington Post. And Kristof concludes saying he's right and says, "We must dispel that stench." That's a tough column some of you may have read in the Salt Lake Tribune. Now, almost over. Remember that professor at American University and pollster, Alan Lichtman? Remember his prediction? Wild and unbelievable when he made it before the election that Donald Trump would win the election, not Hillary Clinton. Lichtman reaffirmed another prediction made at the same time before the general election This prediction was that President Trump would face impeachment during his term. Why? Quote, Republicans are nervous about Donald Trump. He's a loose cannon. They would far prefer Mike Pence. Normally, a viewpoint like this would be quickly ignored. However, Lichtman's startling prediction that Trump would win the election, not Clinton, does grab our attention. He was one of the few pollsters who called the election correctly. He got it right. March 21st, a Yale political science professor and columnist, John Storer, published this column in the New York Times, in the U.S. News and World Report, and he made this observation. Quote, there is a genius to being a con artist and a price. I don't know the answer any more than the founding fathers did. What I do know is that our democracy is in trouble, that what's being destroyed cannot be easily restored, and that even if Trump becomes his own worst enemy, we have all lost. Now, I was just about to end my speech with that quote, and then I read the Deseret News this morning. And some of you may have as well. A story written by my friend Lisa Riley Roche. Evan McMullen, Utah's 2016 presidential candidate, is quoted at length in the Deseret News this morning with this headline. Evan McMullen hints he knows still secret details about Trump's ties to Russia. McMullen, a former CIA agent, speaking yesterday, said, quote, there are things I know that I haven't made public. I honestly believed, and still do, that Donald Trump presents a danger to the country. We learned 9 days ago the very shocking news that our president's team, and potentially the president, is under FBI investigation for potential collaboration with one of our greatest foreign adversaries. Now, in early 2016, McMullen was in Washington, D.C., not in Utah, working for the Republican National Committee, before he decided to become a candidate for president as an alternative to the Republican nominee, Donald Trump. In 2016, McMullen said, quote, there was concern about Russia's efforts to influence our election well before the election among Republican leadership. They chose not to act. McMullen knew about the controversial dossier made public in January indicating Russia's government has compromising information on Donald Trump. Compromising is in the eye of the beholder. What embarrassments? Would it constitute blackmail? McMullen concluded, there are people who are connecting the dots, and I will leave it to them, referring to the FBI. That stuff, all of it, needs to be investigated. Now, in summary, what have we learned? Our nation's constitution is strong. Our nation has survived the presidential years of Andrew Jackson and Richard Nixon. Being an optimistic person, I want to believe that our nation can survive the unprecedented president, Donald Trump. Thank you.
We want to thank the Department of Continuing Education and Community Engagement at the University of Utah for letting us record and broadcast the Frederick W. Reynolds Lecture Series this hour. Professor Tim Chambliss delivered his talk, Trump, the Unprecedented President, last week on March 29th, 2017. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW. Thank you for listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour.